from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Hong Kong's civil servants returned to work, and some schools reopened on Monday as the crowds of students appeared to dissipate on the ninth day of protests in the city. At regional government headquarters, the scene was described as orderly, despite some protesters remaining in the area. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
Hong Kong's central government offices, which usually operate 24 hours a day, had been shut down for 3 days. Protesters have blocked all entrances to the headquarters since last Friday. After consultations between the government and protesters, this passage was cleared out last night. This entrance at the East Wing is one of the three entrances to the headquarters building, with the other two still blocked. The nine-day protests have dealt a heavy blow to Hong Kong's social order. Being closed for a week, middle school students in the Wan Chai and Central Western districts returned to school Monday morning.
We couldn't go to school for a few days. Our curriculum has been delayed as well as tests. I have to review my work and do my homework from home.
But kindergartens and primary schools still remain closed. The Regional Education Bureau says the safety of students is the main concern and hopes all schools can reopen soon. Those who were fortunate enough to get to class left home early this morning to make sure they arrived on time. After missed many days, students have to make up for the lost time the best they can.
The transportation is fine this morning. Students have come back to school smoothly. Their classes have been affected slightly, but things are back on track. We've arranged to make up the missing classes. We've also told our students to be sensible and inclusive of different ideas.
Meanwhile, 30% of the city's bus routes, having been blocked by protesters for more than a week, are slowly getting back to normal. To cope with the disruptions, city officials are adding extra shuttle buses in certain parts of the city to help commuters. But it still might take longer for the city to truly get back to normal. Gene Chow, CCTV.
On Sunday, Hong Kong's Assistant Secretary of Education, Sophia Wang, announced the reopening of schools that had been closed Friday in the face of street protests. Some government buildings had also been closed, but those have, in the main, reopened as of Monday. A big surprise in Brazil's presidential election Sunday. President Dilma Rousseff and Aécio Neves will face each other in a runoff round later this month to determine the country's next president. Rousseff won the first round Sunday with 41.5%, followed by Neves with 33.6%. The big surprise was the poor showing of Marina Silva, who had been running only 5% behind Rousseff shortly after she took the place of her party's first candidate, Eduardo Campos, when he was killed in a plane crash in August. Silva drew only 21.3%, slightly up from her showing in 2010, when she drew 19.3%. RT's Neil Harvey was in Sao Paulo Sunday as the numbers came in.
The results are in, and it's a bit of a surprise because there is no outright victory for Dilma Rousseff. Instead, she will go into a second round runoff on October the 26th against Aécio Neves of the Social Democrat Party. And that's the big surprise because Marina Silva, who had long been a front runner in this, even the favourite for one brief moment, she slumped in the eventual results with just over 20% of the vote, and she was really abandoned in her hour of need. Brazil's swing voters, they've had a field day throughout this election, and they didn't let us down with one more big surprise right at the end. More than 10 million voters jumping ship, abandoning Marina Silva and jumping on board the Aécio Neves train. So we are going to have that second round runoff. There will be several more days of campaigning, more TV campaigning, a chance for both Rousseff and Neves to try and pick up some more of those swing voters and the floaters. Neves will be full of confidence now. He's been gaining momentum throughout this campaign. Nobody expected him to have such a giant rise in the polls in just the last couple of days. Rousseff, she's been consistent throughout the election, so she won't be concerned with getting just over 40%, and indeed she won in such a second round runoff 4 years ago to become Brazil's first female president. And the Brazilian voters have proved so fickle over the last few weeks, there is absolutely no certainty that she will get re-election. They'll be looking over all of their campaign promises once again and wondering where they can try and pick up those extra few votes that could prove crucial as we revisit this saga once again on October 26th.
A number of cities in eastern Ukraine remain on high alert despite a supposed ceasefire reached September 5th. We begin with this report from Press TV.
In eastern Ukraine, clashes between government forces and pro-Russia militia continue despite a ceasefire deal reached between the warring sides last month. The fighting is mostly around the flashpoint city of Donetsk and the city's airport. Several rockets exploded in the northwestern residential district of Donetsk, setting two houses on fire. Earlier, pro-Russians said three civilians have been killed in the past 24 hours and blamed Ukrainian forces for their death. Ukraine's military has accused the pro-Russians of violating a ceasefire, saying their forces came under attack in several parts of the east, including at the airport. The army spokesman says two Ukrainian servicemen have been killed in the past 24 hours and six wounded in the clashes.
Daria Diegets filed this report from Kiev, in western Ukraine.
Renewed fighting between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian militias in the country's Rostivist claims more civilian lives in the city of Donetsk. The fierce fighting for the local airport is threatening the temporary truce between authorities and pro-Russians.
Ukrainian forces rebelled several attacks on the airport, but non-stop fighting continues and significant numbers of armor, heavy artillery and troops have moved into the area.
According to the authorities of the self-declared Donetsk Republic, the heavy clashes have left dozens of people dead. Shelling is also reported in smaller eastern cities. This is while Kyiv says the truce is being observed.
Observing the ceasefire agreement is very important in terms of getting financial aid from the West and holding the upcoming elections. President Petro Poroshenko needs the truce because if he admits that the agreement doesn't work, he will have admitted defeat.
Meanwhile, experts say that the upsurge in violence threatens the attempts to create a 30-kilometer buffer zone between the positions of pro-Russian militias and Ukrainian army. The establishment of the buffer zone is a part of the ceasefire agreement.
This buffer zone is in fact the new Ukrainian boundary, and border guards are already working there. But of course, this zone cannot be established if shelling continues.
Military experts say the recent border lines do not satisfy the pro-Russians in the east, and they will not give up their fight until capturing the Donetsk airport and the strategically important seaport of Mariupol. Kyiv accuses Moscow of helping pro-Russian militias to seize the airport. Russia, however, denies any involvement but stresses that its volunteers could have traveled to Ukraine. Daria Diegets, Press TV, Kyiv.
From the east, we also have this report from RT's Maria Finoshina in Donetsk.
It's been a week since the official start of classes in eastern Ukraine, but not all schools have been able to open their doors.
This school in central Donetsk was built back in 1935. It survived the Second World War, Nazi Germany bombardment, but was almost completely destroyed during what Kyiv calls its large-scale anti-terror operation.
When a school is hit, both sides are usually quick to claim they are not responsible, as they do not target residential areas. But these cases are all too frequent, and many are deadly. At least three people were killed in Wednesday's shelling of one school in Donetsk, and many others could also be in danger.
We are on the front line. It's very hard. Shelling never stops. The school was badly damaged.
Constant artillery bombardment while we speak proves the principal's words. Jeanne says they had already repaired the school from a previous hit, but another shell brought even more destruction.
I can't get used to it. I can't imagine how stressed the children are because of the constant bombardment.
Repair works continue anyway, and while they get the school ready, they also prepare its basement, a key place for people to still feel safe. It is cold and not very spacious, but it may just be enough to save lives. We meet two old ladies. They used to live in a nearby district, but came here after their homes were destroyed by shells.
They are bombarding us like dogs. It's not a war. It's like the extermination of a nation.
And it was the potential danger or destruction that meant classes just couldn't start.
After we spent months in basements, people want to get back to their normal life.
People's hunger for a peaceful life is immense, but it seems that the war's appetite is just as big, and it is growing. Marie Froshnati in Donetsk, Eastern Ukraine.
The U.S. Supreme Court Monday let stand appeals court rulings, which allow same-sex marriage in five states, apparently signaling the practical end to legal challenges to marriage equality in the U.S. and clearing the way to the altar for same-sex couples in Indiana, Oklahoma, Utah, Virginia, and Wisconsin. The court let stand decisions from three federal appeals courts that also have jurisdiction over six other states which ban same-sex marriage: Colorado, Kansas, North and South Carolina, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Those appeals courts seem poised to strike down the additional bans in those states as well, which would bring the number of states with legal same-sex marriage in the U.S. to 30. Sunday saw the close of a controversy involving one of our favorite commentators and the most famous working journalist to ever report on a regular basis from death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was invited by a majority of the student body at his alma mater, Goddard College in Vermont, to address commencement ceremonies this past weekend. Despite pressure from the outside to drop his presentation, the college stood firm, and Mumia addressed the graduates as scheduled with a pre-recorded message from behind the walls, courtesy of Noel Hanrahan from Prison Radio.
Dear fellow Goddardites, students, graduates, parents, professors, I thank you for your kind invitation to join you in voice today. I've been away from Goddard College perhaps longer than most of you have been alive. I last walked on campus during the late 70s. But although it was undoubtedly quite a long time ago, it still sits in memory, and sometimes even visits in dreams of the funky atmosphere that suffused the campus like a cloud of exhaled marijuana smoke. What really moved me, however, was the green life, the abundance of grass, trees standing like ancient sentinels, the majestic mountains of Vermont, which possessed a beauty that was, to a guy from the city, simply breathtaking. I remember, with crystal clarity, walking through the woods back to our dorms, Third World Studies, and feeling pure rapture in the presence of those trees. How many centuries had those trees stood on this earth? My mind looked back to Indians who must have trod through these very same woods, my steps touching the ground that once crunched under their moccasined feet. Not only have the surviving remnant of their once great numbers been banished from the land of their fathers, but the reverence with which they held these lands, their collective embrace of Mother Earth, has been banished as well. That living immensity, more sacred than anything built by man, has never left me and rises up like a phoenix whenever I think of the campus. But of course, what really matters here is not my experience, but yours. This is your commencement, and as such, I will dwell on the world that you are about to enter into, inhabit, and true to Goddard's founding ideals, hopefully transform. As we all know, Goddard is rightly famous for its non-traditional teaching methods and focus. Here, students stand at the center of the educational endeavor, and they are urged and expected to follow that vibe in their hearts, that which gives them passion to determine not just what they will study, but how those studies can have impact and meaning in the larger society. You know, this ain't a cookie-cutter school. Goddard, deeply influenced by the ideas of John Dewey, 1859-1952, strives to reach that happy and singular medium between the teacher and the taught, with one exploring with the other how best to achieve a meaningful resolution to questions that arise in the life of the mind. Quoting Dewey, education is not preparation for life. It is life itself. Dear graduates, never have words such as these been truer to the hour that is upon us. For the nation is in deep trouble, largely because old thinking, both domestically and globally, has led us into the morass that the nation now faces, which may be encapsulated by references to place names that ring in our minds: Gaza, Ferguson, and Iraq again. These are some of the challenges that abide in the world, which it will be your destiny to try to analyze and resolve. As students of Goddard, you know that these challenges are not easy, but they must be faced and addressed. The Brazilian scholar Paulo Freire, in his groundbreaking Pedagogy of the Oppressed, posits the power of literacy to transform psychology, to deepen and broaden one's place in the world. Moreover, when one seeks to interrogate one's radical beliefs, it draws one deeper into contact with the meaning of social change and social transformation. One is changed, the prerequisite to social change. Goddard, because of its size and orientation, has given students the time and attention to find the focus to answer questions that few other places have even dared to entertain. In many ways, it is issues such as these that makes Goddard Goddard. Questions of power, of politics, of race, of gender, of place. Questions about where one stands in the world and how to move, act, interact in a world awash in complexity. Essentially, how does a young person, or for that matter, even an older one, looking at the vast, wide world with a quiet sense of terror, have a voice amidst that monstrous din? How does she find that voice that can create space to think, to be, to grow? We know that it must come from the place within, that which moves you, that which stirs you, that which is your truest, deepest self. Goddard, unlike most such institutions of higher learning, quietly asks that you listen to and interrogate that voice, and when appropriate, amplify it. For who knows, within that deepest you may dwell the very voice that is resonating within the nation, if not the world itself. Here, social change and social transformation forms the raison d'etre of Goddard. We need new questions for the world of the 21st century. But more importantly, we need new answers. We live in a world where massive wars can be launched by rumors and innuendo, where the material interests of corporations are superior to the interests of working people. And remember, corporations are people, so saith the Supreme Court, where the ecological threats to fresh water supplies, clean air, and the environment in American cities pose challenges that seemed beyond our ken. Did I not say that we need new thinking? The present social, political, ecological, and global course is, to say the least, unsustainable. Perhaps some of you, new graduates of Goddard, will think up ways to forestall some of the challenges facing the living and generations unborn. I noted earlier my reverie in the woods of Goddard, that exquisite freshness in the wintry air, the nighttime respiration of hundreds of magnificent evergreen trees, has refreshed my mind even when miles and decades away from Goddard's sweet, cool earth. Our cities, built during the heights of the industrial age and now engulfed in post-industrial ennui, badly need a greening. Areas should be set aside where children and mothers can breathe and remember air loaded with freshness delivered by green life, not air-conditioned. Think of the myriad of problems that beset this land and strive to make it better. That's Dewey's vision and Goddard's. Let me say something that I've never said before. When I came to Goddard, I was intimidated. Although teachers and adults told me that I could do the work, I rarely believed them. I felt woefully unprepared. But guess what? Goddard gave me confidence, and I never lost that feeling. When I returned to Goddard, many years later, I was a man on death row with a date to die. I was able to transfer credits from continuing education, and my final paper utilized the writings of Frantz Fanon and Ignacio Martín Baró to examine the concepts of both in liberation psychology and liberation theology. Only at Goddard. Only at Goddard. Goddard reawakened in me my love of learning. In my mind, I left death row to travel to France, where Fanon studied psychiatry, and on to Bleda Hospital, north of Algiers, where he practiced and later joined the Algerian Revolution. By studying Martín Baró, I traveled to El Salvador, where he worked as a priest and psychologist, teaching literacy to peasants. When the nation groaned under military terror, supported by El Norte, the U.S. Empire. Who were these figures? Well, Fanon was born in the Caribbean island of Martinique, then a colony of France. When he witnessed the oppression of the Arabs in Algeria, he felt compelled to join the revolution on the side of what he called the wretched of the earth. Ignacio Martin Baró was among six Jesuit priests, a housekeeper and her daughter, slain by the U.S.-trained Atlacatlo Battalion, a notorious Salvadoran death squad. Goddard supported those trips abroad, if only in the mind. And I thank the school and many of my friends and alums there immensely for opening a door closed for decades. Goddard allowed me to really study what interested and moved me, revolutionary movements. And through that doorway, history, psychology, politics, and of course, economics. In one of the most repressive environments on earth, death row, Goddard allowed me to study and research human liberation and anti-colonial struggles on two continents, Africa and Latin Central America. I thank you for that grand opportunity. For you graduates, your studies, visits to lands beyond your own, were done to give you both insights and confidence to work in the world, to try to create social change. Your job isn't how to get a job. It's to make a difference. I thank my friends at Goddard for inviting me back. If it's done for you half of what it's done for me, I assure you, you will have been well served. Now take what you know and apply it in the real world. Help be the change you're seeking to make. I thank you all. For the class of 1996, Goddard, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Despite the ever-increasing numbers of protesters who filled streets in the U.S. from the mid-1960s until the end of the Vietnam War in 1973, it was not until the mostly student-led protests were joined by growing numbers of people serving in the military that the dissent became generally recognized as a mature social movement.
Each day to facilitate the process by which the United States washes her hands of Vietnam, someone has to give up his life, so that the United States doesn't have to admit something that the entire world already knows, so that we can't say that we've made a mistake. Someone has to die so that President Nixon won't be, and these are his words, the first president to lose a war. And we are asking Americans to think about that. Because how do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? We are here to ask, and we're here to ask vehemently, where are the leaders of our country? Where is the leadership?
That was the current Secretary of State John Kerry testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in April of 1971 as a part of a delegation of soldiers who had served in Vietnam. Less than 2 years later, with the passage of the Chase-Church Amendment in March of 1973, U.S. intervention in Vietnam was ended. A similar dissatisfaction with U.S. involvement in the Middle East has been noted and is now growing rapidly among troops, according to Mike Preisner of March Forward. He spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar and discussed the widespread opposition among rank-and-file soldiers to President Obama's latest moves to send more ground troops into combat in Iraq and Syria.
Since June, the President of the United States has been saying that there's going to be, quote, no boots on the ground in Iraq. All the while, they were sending boots, but just not the boots that they want us to consider boots. So the U.S. troops in Iraq and U.S. forces in Iraq over the past couple of months have been built up to a number around 2,000. But they're not acknowledged as boots on the ground because these are special forces soldiers, they're Apache pilots, they're drone operators. So they fall into kind of a shadowy category that the U.S. government doesn't want us to consider U.S. troops in a general sense. And so they're not calling them boots on the ground because they're this other thing, even though they very much are U.S. forces with guns and with weapons. But on September 25th, all of that changed. They couldn't even, avoid this boots-on-the-ground categorization of special forces soldiers, because around 500 U.S. soldiers from the 1st Infantry Division, a tank unit, were activated for a new deployment rotation, a year-long deployment rotation to Baghdad, Erbil, and other cities. And these are regular Army soldiers, you know, that would fall under that category of boots on the ground. And it's important to note what type of unit this is. These 500 soldiers from the 1st Infantry Division are the headquarters element of a division brigade combat team. So this headquarters unit is the center of command and control for the larger division, you know, the headquarters of the broader unit. That means while they're saying that this is all they're sending for now, just this headquarters element, it very much sets the stage for the other units in the division to follow behind. You know, why send a headquarters if you're not planning on having the unit that the headquarters command join them at some point? And ironically, this was one of the first units, the 1st Infantry Division, to be deployed to the Middle East in advance of the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. And these are year-long deployments, and so it's not just one time that this is happening. They've been put on notice to now the 1st Infantry Division soldiers will have a year-long deployment to Baghdad, to Erbil, and other places in Iraq. And the Army Chief of Staff, General Ray Odierno, said that this is going to be necessary for 10 to 15 to 20 years. So just like that, people who are not even born yet are sentenced to be deploying to occupy Iraq. And given the widespread opposition to the Iraq War between 2003 until the troops pulled out, it's almost surreal to see that this is that we're back occupying Iraq just like that, with really no nothing in the headlines, no big discussion about it. It just happened. Deployments to Iraq are back. But in addition to this unit of 500 that could become more, the Pentagon just announced on October 1st the creation of a new Marine Corps unit of 2,300 Marines that are stationed in Kuwait to act as what the military calls a quick reaction force. A quick reaction force is a combat-ready unit that can get to a combat zone in less than 24 hours. So they're to be stationed in Kuwait now, this 2,300 Marines, and the Marine Commandant, General Amos, said that this force can be deployed immediately to any crisis in the Middle East, be it in Syria, be it anywhere else, but in particular said that these Marines right now are ready to reinforce the embassy in Baghdad, rescue downed pilots in Iraq, and support Iraqi forces that are in combat in Iraq. So the promise of no boots on the ground very, very quickly became a large number of boots on the ground, and the return of regular deployment for regular Marines, regular soldiers, and our plan to continue indefinitely.
What are some of the implications for what we're seeing just with this breaking news?
It's important to know why the president kept promising that there was going to be, quote, no boots on the ground in Iraq. And that's because he knows that the people of the United States and people in the military don't want another disaster in Iraq, don't want another war in Iraq. And so they kept saying it because of that reality. You know, having to repeat no boots on the ground doesn't sound like the words of a commander who feels that the people of the country would be behind him if he made that decision. So they say one thing for public consumption, and then they do other very different things behind closed doors. Very quickly, U.S. troops could be enduring heavy casualties from a wide variety of armed fighters, just like last time, not just from ISIS, but from all the same forces that succeeded in exerting enough military pressure and enough casualties on the United States to be a factor in forcing the withdrawal of the U.S. military. And so very quickly, we could all of a sudden be back in the same situation we were during the disaster of the Iraq occupation from 2003 to 2011. And what will happen then? When U.S. soldiers start dying in Iraq, will the U.S. government just get us out of there, or will they send more and more to die? Their track record in Iraq and Afghanistan makes it not look very good for service members and their families right now.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.